Thank you for inviting me here today to share with you some of our research and outreach activities in North Central Washington. Basically, we did introduce canola up in this region, so we've got some data that we're still working on, but we've found out quite a few things thus far to help some of the growers. What I want to do today is describe the climate. I know Jack Brown did a little bit yesterday of the Pacific Northwest. It's very, very unique. And one of the things I'm finding out listening yesterday and today and with our data, that a lot of this stuff is really site specific and determined is determined by where you conduct the research, where your growers are farming. I want to briefly describe the description of the area of the two counties, Okanagan and Douglas County, where we're working. A few reasons why we're introducing winter canola versus some of the other crops, be them oilseed or not. Very briefly touch on the research, but the thing that I think has come about from our research more than anything is we've got an informal partnership that has pulled everything together for this community up there. And I wanna share that with everyone today. Well, the Pacific Northwest has a Mediterranean climate where we get 60 to 70% of our moisture in the wintertime. Not much in the summer at all. In the world, the Mediterranean climate is very sparse. Basically, it's found on the 40 degree north and 40 degree south latitude, just very tips of some of the countries in the world. The two counties where we've been doing our work is in the Okanagan and Douglas County in the north central portion, leading from beginning from the Canadian border down to the central part of the state, and it's centralized east and west as well. Where we're actually conducting the experiments and the farmers are growing canola, in Okanagan County, a lot of the land is at the base of foothills where they graze their cattle during the year. And so it's kind of shallow soil, shaley type of soil. And in Douglas County, it's very shallow and rocky soil. And a lot of the fields, we call them haystack country. They're big boulders sticking up in the middle of the field or piles of rock that the growers have moved into one area so that they're not hitting them all the time. No-till is basically out of the picture because of the shallow soil, the rocks, etc. They've been doing a two-year rotation of winter wheat summer fallow for a little over a century. And they're in drastic need of an alternative crop up in that region for the economy, diversity of markets, et cetera. One of the other characteristics of this region is winter annual grass weeds, giant goatgrass, downy brome, feral rye. I've worked with goatgrass and downy brome for about 25 years. I've been working with feral rye for four. And I think it's a much worse weed than the other two. It is really difficult to get rid of. It's a very vigorous grass. It mimics the life cycle of wheat, as do the other two weeds, and that makes it very difficult to control in winter wheat. Well, the projects, our canola project objectives were, first of all, to introduce winter canola to the local growers in this region. Basically, we drop back to agronomy 101. What's the best planting date, rate, methodology, some of that stuff, even to the point that this is canola, not wheat or barley. The second objective was to create a multiple agency partnership that is focusing on the Colville tribe to improve human and animal health, self-sustainability, and stimulate the local economy by creating jobs. There's a lot of economic studies out there that basically say that if you generate a dollar in the area and you keep it there, it circulates three times around. So rather than going to the Shell station or the Chevron station, we're going and giving that dollar to them, it leaves the community. But if we can produce biodiesel in the community, which the Colville tribe wants to do, they want to become pretty much self-sustainable and have their crushing plant, processing plant, and provide biodiesel for their logging trucks, their school buses, and other vehicles. As with a lot of other speakers, our number one problem is stand establishment. This is one of the growers' fields in the fall of 2005. This actually isn't a bad stand when it comes down to it. We do have areas where we can have weeds popping through. I'm sorry to say that us in our research plots, we were able to replicate the poor stand, and it's one of those things where, you know, we haven't got everything solved yet either. And some of the girls are, what are you doing, Frank? But anyway, that was the impetus of the project in the wheat fallow area. Due to the USDA budget cuts, we're using a modified 46-year-old John Deere HZ deep furrow drill. Curtis Hennings has been one of our cooperators for 15 years. He actually started modifying a section of this drill by putting 15-inch shovels on to move the hot soil away from the seed row in our fallow situation. August, September, the dry fluff, the 4 to 5 inches that's above the soil moisture, temperatures reach 120 to 140 degrees Fahrenheit. And it just cooks those little seedlings coming up that was planted in the moisture. So what the shovels were trying to do is move a lot of that hot soil away so that the seedlings would have maybe 1 to 2 inches of hot soil to go through, which would lower their exposure time. We then also put a grass seed box that more accurately dispenses our seed for our rate studies. And then we put 50-pound packer wheels on the end that goes right over the seed row to really seat the seed in the soil. Why winter canola? Like I said, the growers wanted something to improve their pest management strategies. One of our cooperators in Douglas County 4 years ago took a $1.45 a bushel hit due to feral rye dockage in his wheat. And that was with wheat being $3.50 to $4, not the present day prices of $6.50. This would diversify their markets. It would give them a crop that they could either sell for oil or biodiesel, plus the meal for the livestock in the region. These two counties have the highest livestock populations in the state of Washington, so there's a nice source for them to distribute their meal as well. It's going to increase their sustainability, both for the Colville tribes and the farmers. We've had several farmers say that preparing their wheat ground following canola, they're able to cut out 1 to 2 major tillage operations in their fallow, which then, you know, completes the circle. It's going to reduce erosion, make cleaner air, et cetera, et cetera. But the big problem up there is their late spring. Snow stays a long time. They can't get out on the ground very early in the spring, and yields aren't very good at all doing spring wheat, spring barley, spring canola, or any of those. The first question that was posed to us up in this region was, how late can we plant our winter canola? They asked us to try and find out what would happen if we grew canola, if we planted it after Labor Day. Most of the time we try and plant within an August window. And the reason they do that is most of the growers are also fire district members, and they spend a lot of time in August fighting range fires because nobody else will. They're moving their cattle down from the summer grazing areas to the winter feedlots. They're harvesting wheat and they're planting wheat. So they wanted to know what would happen if they could delay planting until after Labor Day. So the first year, we planted canola at 2, 4, and 6 pounds per acre. We can certainly see that we get an increase in stand establishment, because it's pretty much a numbers game. The more you plant, the more you have emerge and establish. But then when we look at yield, the 6 pounds per acre yielded similarly to the 4 pounds due to the intraspecific competition. We had too many plants there. But the basic thing is we got well under 1,000 pounds per acre on our yield. In contrast, if we planted 4 pounds per acre 10 to 15 days earlier, we increased our yield about 450 to 500 pounds and pushing 1,350 pounds. Again, as with the late planting, we had no additional yield, in fact, a little bit less yield with the 8 pounds per acre. Some of the successes that we've had based on grower cooperations with us and some of our research, basically we've learned to plant when Mother Nature tells us to. And what I mean by that is we've pretty well figured out that from maybe July 30th to August 20th, 25th is our prime time to plant. But the point is, with that hot soil, what we need to do is check the forecasted weather 5 or 6 days in advance and see if we're going to get a cool down period to enable us to plant and get that young seedling up out of the ground out of that 140 degree temperature. The USDA Risk Management Agency has used data to procure winter canola crop insurance beginning this fall for those two counties, and that has generated a lot of interest in the region to grow winter canola. When moisture is less than 2.5 inches, we don't need the shovels. Farmers are never happy. We get a good stand establishment with the shovels, but then they say, well, Frank, now I got to drive over this hilly, furrowed field, and it gets pretty bumpy. I can't take it too much. So what we found was that if that soil moisture is less than 2.5 inches below the soil surface, we don't need shovels to remove that that soil. The hoe openers that we use, which AccuPoint, Eagle Beak, that comes with the HC drill, is sufficient, and then with the packer wheels to take care of that problem. And we've increased winter canola acreage greatly. Basically, when we started in 2007, there was 200 acres being produced in these two counties, and there's over 2,000 acres that were planted this past year. And we have just under 1 million acres that we could plant, within a rotation in this region. Some of the impacts that the research, the knowledge, and everything has had, we've got a Douglas County grower that planted 200 acres in 07, 900 acres in 2010, and he's basically said, winter wheat is now my rotational crop and not winter canola. What he means by that is that he uses winter wheat to clean up his broadleaf weeds that have escaped his winter canola crop. And our Okanagan cooperator has basically said that winter canola is my money crop compared to my 30 bushel winter wheat that I get every 2 years. Switching gears real quick to finish up, I wanted to touch on this partnership that we have going. We've got several members that participate in this partnership. We have the Colville Confederated Tribes that I mentioned want to become self-sustainable. They eventually want to learn to grow canola. They want to crush it, process it, and put it back into their vehicles. We've got USDA, ARS, NRCS, and Risk Management. The local schools, growers, and businesses. WSU Extension has played a major part with us. Washington State Biofuel Project, which has provided some funding for us to do this work, and Washington State Department of Agriculture. To just give you a quick idea of how the partnership should, in theory, work, and it has functioned pretty well up to this point. We were up there because of tribal and grower interest for the reasons we've discussed already. Based on some of our research, the experience from the growers, the knowledge that the growers had prior to us going up there, we've been able to expand our canola production. The tribal crushing and processing facility, we got the crusher going, they're adding a processor, and everything should be up and running this next summer. Then they'll provide the biodiesel for the tribe's vehicles. We have a local business, a feed store, that's going to distribute and handle the meal that's produced in the process. And all of this then adds to the increased producer markets, increased job opportunities, et cetera, for the region. And lastly, I just want to mention, it all came to fruition in 2009 in October. We had a canola recognition day, and what we did was we had individuals of all the segments of the partnership speak to the group. They talked about how they participated in it, what their vision is. And what was really neat is that we had canola that was grown by a local grower on tribal leased land, crushed in the tribal crushing facilities, processed by WSU Extension, and then it was pumped into a Pascal Sherman Indian School bus. So it was pretty good. The kit, and this was all done at an elementary school for the Native Americans, and they got quite a charge out of smelling the French fries coming out the back end of the bus, rather than the black smoke that normally comes out. With that, I think we're probably past questions time, but I'll be here for the rest of the day if anybody has any questions. Thank you very much.